Daily Minutes Podcast, 12 maart 2020. Dit is het bulletin van donderdag. Daily Minutes, 12 maart 2020. Dit is het bulletin van donderdag. Vandaag maak ik me eraf met een Willem Duisje. Tenminste, dit is weer een uitzending voor de vuist weg. En niet een gescripte, zoals de afgelopen twee keren. Misschien is hij dan wel wat langer, want ik ben meestal nogal lang van stof. Maar ik weet het niet. Ik heb vanochtend een halve verhuizing gedaan vanochtend. Flink aantal verhuisdozen van de ene plek naar de andere versjouwd. En vanmiddag ook nog wat. Dus ik zit zelfs te geeuwen. Dat is ook niet de bedoeling. Nou, en dan tik ik nog tegen de microfoon aan. Ploink. Nou ja, het is goed te zien in het scopebeeld. Eigenlijk heb ik wel zin in koffie. En mijn stem is niet helemaal op peil, merk ik wel. Nou ja, het wordt een gemankeerde uitzending, vrees ik. Geen coronagrappen vandaag. Of moeten de bosjes besmetmennetjes zijn die bij de bloemisten in Nederland zo'n grote hit zijn momenteel? Wat had ik nog meer? Nou, laat ik maar eens even kijken of er wat nieuws is of zo. Of misschien moet ik wat uit mijn duim zuigen. Nou, er is toch wel iets te melden. Op het gebied van LPAM, de middengolfzenders, Radio-TV-Nederland.nl, ik moet het goed zeggen, die maakt bekend dat op de 11e van deze maand de 100ste LPAM-vergunning is uitgegeven. De 100ste. Wow. In Bladel is het. En een bijgewerkt overzicht is er te vinden. Nou, ik zal eens kijken of er hier nog wat in de buurt zit. Maar het gaat dus goed met die zenders. Het zijn er heel wat. Er is wel weer een eenwatter. Die hebben natuurlijk maar een beperkt bereik. Maar het is toch leuk. En het is leuk dat er zoveel belangstelling voor is. Ik had al gedacht dat die belangstelling er was. Maar het is toch meer dan dat ik vermoed had zelfs. Dus dat is heel leuk. Ja, nou ja, ik kan toch niet om het nieuws heen. In Duitsland is de Funktag in Kassel. Die op 18 april zou plaatsvinden. Die is afgelast. Ham Radio Event. De 5e Funktag. Die zal niet plaatsvinden. Over een jaar. Hopelijk als het dan geen corona is, gaan we dan vanuit. Maar ik had er toch wel vanuit dat het tegen die tijd ofwel een vaccin is of iets anders. Maar dat het toch wel anders zal zijn dan het nu is. Het is zeker niet de enige die afgelast is. Ook Ham Radio Events in Noorwegen zijn afgelast. En het International DX Convention, de International DX Convention die in Visalia, ja, in Californië zou plaatsvinden van 12 tot 14 april is ook afgelast. Ja, ik kan nog wel even doorgaan, maar er is gewoon een hele reeks evenementen. En ook de Radio Vlooienmarkt in Rosmalen, die is al afgelast. En die zit natuurlijk in de hotspot Brabant, die Brabant momenteel is. Laten we het over iets anders hebben. Misschien kunnen we het even over techniek hebben. Nou, mijn zelfbouwprojecten die zijn nog niet erg gevlot, moet ik bekennen. Maar goed, ik heb genoeg te doen momenteel. Dus daar kan ik niet zoveel over melden. Ik ben vandaag wel portabel geweest, maar dat was op 2 meter heel kort. Dus dat was niet zo bijzonder. Wandelend op de fiets, daar heb ik wel een headsetje voor. Maar ik vind het koptelefoontje daarvan niet zo fijn. Dat ding dat moet heel hard staan. En dan heb ik thuis, als ik thuis kom, een piep horen. En daar ben ik nog niet bepaald van gediend. Dus ik zit te denken om het speakertje wel te gebruiken. Het microfoontje wel te gebruiken, maar het speakertje van de porto zelf. Maar ja, dan moet ik weer een verloopstukje maken die dat mogelijk maakt. Kortom, op de fiets nog even niet QRV. Op de site van de Veerland, daar is te vinden dat de radiomarkt in Helmond na 9 jaar afwezig te zijn geweest, dat die wel gewoon doorgaat. Ik ga er toch eigenlijk vanuit dat dat niet zo is. Hè? Maar ja, het is kleinschalig, staat erbij. En het is wel erg zo dat mensen, dat als het 100 mensen groot was, minder dan 100 mensen, dan kon het nog. Hè? Dus ja. Eergisteren kwam weer de nieuwsbrief uit van het IARO Monitoring System, de vroegere Intruder Watch. Ja, het is eigenlijk niet heel, even kijken hoor, meestal militaire stations, heel veel data van militairen zit er in de amateurbanden en ook allerlei over de horizonradars. Dat is toch wel een fenomeen wat nogal opkomt de laatste jaren. En ja, verder zijn er natuurlijk de bekende vissers weer, de radioboeien in de hogere banden, het is wat. Ook daar is er niet zo heel veel nieuws ten opzichte van de afgelopen maanden te melden. Geen opvallende nieuwe ontwikkelingen. Taxichauffeurs en de 10 meter heb je natuurlijk ook nog. Ja. Ja. Ik zit te denken, kan ik snel wat over antennes improviseren? Maar dat is natuurlijk ook lastig. Wat wel grappig is dat ik wel eens mensen gesproken heb die een 5/8 golf dan een heel goede antenne vonden. Want ja, op 2 meter werkt dat natuurlijk voortreffelijk. Op een auto een 5/8, dat is beter dan een halve golf. En dan dachten ze van nou, ik ga voor HF iets maken. En dan maakten ze ook een 5/8 horizontale draad. Ja, dat werkt dus niet. Want een 5/8 werkt alleen maar goed als die verticaal opgesteld staat op een aardoppervlak. En niet horizontaal, dus dat werkt niet. Als je langere antenne maakt dan een halve golf, dan gaat hij ook de andere kant uitstralen. Dus dan gaat hij in de lengte richting van de draad uitzenden. En daar ga je met een 5/8 al redelijk naartoe. Dan zit je net een beetje ertussenin, zeg maar. Dus dan krijg je een vrij grillig stralingspatroon. In ieder geval niet wat je zou willen. Draadantennes is het toch altijd lastig. Hè? Maar het is op korte golf altijd improviseren. Op VHF en UHF kun je de parameters van een antenne wat beter in de hand houden. En gewoon een full size maken waar ook alle ruimte voor is en ook ruimte eromheen. Maar bij een korte golf is het vaak zo dat zo'n antenne zo verschrikkelijk lang wordt, een full size. Ja, dan is die al vele malen langer dan het gebouw waar die bij staat en allerlei andere objecten. En dan moet je toch, om binnen je grondstuk te blijven, moet je allerlei compromissen sluiten. Dus een antenne is altijd een compromis. En ja, een antenne voor één band, dan kun je natuurlijk nog wel dat optimaliseren. Maar als je dan ook al wil dat het voor meerdere banden werkt, ja, dan doe je altijd iets af aan de werking per band. Dus een multiband DX-antenne is niet zo makkelijk te maken. Dat is echt wel een beetje de uitdaging. Eigenlijk moet je dan wel een éénband antenne hebben. Wat ik altijd wel grappig vind, is dat mensen denken dat antennes uit heel veel bijzondere typen bestaan. Maar er zijn eigenlijk maar een paar basisvormen. In feite is een dipool zo'n basisvorm. En zelfs een quad antenne kun je als dipool opvatten, een quad element. Maar een dipool die kun je in het midden voeden, maar je kunt hem ook op het uiteinde voeden. Dus in beide gevallen is het een halve golfstraler met vrijwel dezelfde eigenschappen. Je hebt wel iets verschil dat de coax op een ander punt eraan vast zit. Maar die verschillen zijn niet zo verschrikkelijk groot. En een quad element is eigenlijk gewoon een gevouwen dipool. Die een beetje uitgerekt is. Hè. Dus de lengte is wel net zo groot. Maar ja, dat verandert wel iets door de vorm. Maar niet zo verschrikkelijk veel. En in feite is het gewoon een halve dipool. Dus wat een beetje een raar ding is. Dat is de Moxon die ik dan nu aan het maken ben. Maar ja, dat is in feite ook gewoon een Yagi. Waarvan de punten naar elkaar toe gebogen zijn. Dat heeft consequenties. Dus de afmetingen worden wat anders. Maar op zich is het toch wel gewoon een twee-elements Yagi. Die een beetje raar in elkaar zit. Dus ik denk dat ik maar ophoud. Ik heb niet zo gruwelijk veel te vertellen vandaag, denk ik. Ik denk dat het met alle trek- en sjouwwerk te maken heeft gehad. Ik heb behoorlijk wat, ik denk al een paar honderd kilo spullen verplaatst heb. En daar ben ik niet zo gewend. En mijn conditie is niet super goed. Zeker na wat gezondheidsproblemen van de afgelopen tijd niet. Dus ik ben dat weer een beetje aan het opbouwen. Dus ik denk dat daardoor mijn reserves een beetje verbruikt zijn. Ik heb niet super veel honger trouwens. Ik heb wel lekker eten voor straks. Dat dan weer wel. Eens even kijken, ik heb nog volgens mij 1 of 2 columns van Onno liggen die ik nog niet gebruikt heb. Het zou er 1 kunnen zijn of 2. Ik zend ze gewoon alle 2 uit. En dan als de tweede een herhaling blijkt te zijn, nou ja, dan zijn er toch vast een aantal mensen die het nog niet gehoord hebben. Volgens mij heb ik, het ERRL bulletin is er ook. Dus die kan ik ook erbij doen. Ongetwijfeld is die er. Dan hebben we in ieder geval ook nog wat Engels. Want ik heb niet het gevoel dat ik nou een echt diepgravende uitzending gemaakt heb. En dat zullen misschien wel mensen me bij eens zijn. Dat hoef ik niet te vertellen. Maar ik denk dat de volgende keer weer heel gewoon een gescripte is. Nou, heel gewoon, want zo gewoon is dat de laatste tijd niet. Maar op NOS was die altijd gescript. En dat ik verder ga op het onderwerp over propagatie. En dat ga ik zeker doen.
This is ARRL Audio News. Your weekly summary of news highlights from the world of amateur radio.
I'm Carla Pereira, KC1HSX, and these are our stories for Friday, March 6th. A jury for the U.S. District Court of the Northern District of Illinois has awarded Motorola Solutions damages of $764.6 million in a theft of trade secrets and copyright infringement lawsuit against Hytera Communications of Shenzhen, China. In early 2017, Motorola filed complaints in federal court alleging that Hytera's digital mobile radio products employ techniques and systems that infringe on Motorola Solutions patents and trade secrets. already known for its land mobile radio service products, Hytera entered the amateur radio DMR market in 2016. Its ham products include the Hytera AR482GI digital mobile radio. Motorola alleged that proprietary and patented information was taken illegally by three former company engineers who went to work for Hytera. The company said it would seek a global injunction to prevent Hytera from trade secret misappropriation and copyright infringement. Motorola said technology features that it had developed started showing up in Hytera products soon after Hytera began hiring former Motorola engineers in 2008. The court victory marks Motorola's fourth legal win against Hytera. In 2018, the U.S. International Trade Commission ruled that Hytera had infringed several Motorola patents and issued an exclusion order preventing the importation, distribution, or sale of Hytera products found to be infringing the Motorola patents. Two courts in Germany also ruled that Hytera infringed on Motorola patents and implemented injunctions against those infringing products. In a statement, Hytera expressed disappointment and disagreement with the verdict. Hytera said it's engaged in an ongoing process of removing the affected source code from the products at issue. With Dayton Hamvention 2020 a little more than 10 weeks away, Hamvention officials say they are closely following the coronavirus situation. Show organizers will post updates as the May 15 through 17 event nears, but they're optimistic that coronavirus will not be an issue. Quote, "At this time, the Hamvention Executive Committee has been in contact with the Greene County Public Health Department, and we do not anticipate any impact because of this issue," unquote, a March 3rd Hamvention statement said. The Greene County Public Health Department reports that no cases of coronavirus have been confirmed in Ohio. Greene County Public Health is working closely with the Ohio Department of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and are prepared to respond should there be a community spread of COVID-19, the Hamvention statement noted. The YASME Foundation presented its Excellence Award to the individuals responsible for reactivating the United Nations Headquarters amateur radio station 4U1UN. The project took more than 4 years to complete. As announced earlier, those receiving the award are James Sarti, K2QI, and Adrian Siuperka, KO8SCA. The team used an innovative in-house remote concept. The station is located on the 42nd floor of UN headquarters in New York City, while the control point is on the ground floor. Jointly presenting the award will be ARRL Hudson Division Director Rhea Jiram, N2RJ, and YASME Director Marty Lane, OH2BH. Following the presentation, K2QI, G6CBR, N2RJ, OH2BH, KO8SCA, and VE7NY will activate 41UN for the ARRL International DX SSB contest. In DX News, 60100 is on the air from Mogadishu, Somalia through March 25th. If you need Zambia, listen for 9J2LA until March 15th. TO7DL is active from Reunion Island through March 16th, and you can catch 9X2AW from Rwanda until March 22nd. EX0QR is on the air from Kyrgyzstan today through March 17th, and finally, 3B9AN can be heard occasionally from Rodrigues Island starting March 9th and continuing through the 18th. For a special event activity, W5S is on the air through March 12th in Oklahoma City in celebration of the C-47 SkyTrain aircraft. Looking ahead to next week, W1M will be on the air on March 14th from Russell, Massachusetts for Scouts Camps on the Air. K7T will be active from Tucson, Arizona on the 14th for the Battle of Pikachu Peak anniversary. NI6IW will be operating from the USS Midway Museum ship in San Diego on March 14th. N2RE will be celebrating Pi Day on March 14th and 15th from Princeton, New Jersey. K9TAL in Indianapolis will be making contacts on the 14th for the American Legion's 101st birthday. And on March 16th through the 22nd, listen for one of 12 stations slated to be active during the Maine Bicentennial Celebration. For complete details, see the March issue of QST Magazine.
And now with this week's satellite update, here's Bruce Page, KK5DO.
Are you new to ham radio? Do you want to make a satellite contact but just do not know where to start? You're not alone, and AMSAT is prepared to make it a bit easier for you. Join us the day before Hamvention on Thursday, May 14th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Dara Clubhouse for a full day of instruction designed for both beginners and advanced amateur radio satellite operators. The Academy will be taught by some of the most accomplished AMSAT operators. Topics covered will be working FM, linear transponder, and digital satellites. You also get a copy of Getting Started with Amateur Satellites, the 2020 edition, a one-year basic membership to AMSAT, and a pizza buffet lunch. Registration is open at the AMSAT online store and closes May 8th. There will be no sign-ups at the door. This is Bruce Page, KK5DO, for the ARRL Audio News.
This is the ARRL Propagation Forecast for Friday, March 6th. The sun is blank as usual, but geomagnetic conditions remain fairly quiet. We do have a minor blast of solar wind arriving for the weekend, but it really isn't expected to cause any serious problems. For the week to come, look for good conditions on 160 through 60 meters and possibly 40 meters as well. On VHF and UHF, there are two zones of triple activity that hams in southern Louisiana and North Carolina can expect to see in the week to come. According to reports, there have been some pretty serious band openings taking place in both zones, and this is likely to continue.
And that concludes ARRL Audio News for this week. Our thanks to all contributors to this week's report. ARRL Audio News is produced by the American Radio Relay League, the National Association for Amateur Radio. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment about ARRL Audio News, email us at audionews@arrl.org. This program is copyright ARRL, all rights reserved. 73, and thanks for listening.
Welcome to the On the Air podcast, a companion to On the Air magazine, a new bi-monthly magazine from ARRL for beginner to intermediate ham radio licensees. I'm your host and the editor of On the Air magazine, Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY. Every month, the On the Air podcast extends material found in On the Air magazine to help you learn about the many things the ham radio service and hobby has to offer. Welcome to the March 2020 episode. This month, we'll take a closer look at material from the March-April 2020 issue, including more information about feedline loss, as well as analog versus digital transceivers, and we'll get some insight into how to become a severe weather spotter with Skywarn. Let's get into it. The March-April 2020 cover article, Untangling Feedlines, presents an overview of the main types of feedline and how to choose one. One of the main factors in that decision is loss. Every type of feedline has some level of loss, meaning that some of the power that your transceiver sends into the feedline gets lost. It's converted into heat and goes away. And so you end up with less power reaching your antenna. Loss works the same way on the signals that are coming back to your radio from your antenna. There are several online feedline loss calculators that can help you decide which cable is best for your setup. As just one example, Harold Melton, KV5R, has a calculator at kv5r.com/ham-radio/coax-loss-calculator. That calculator asks you to choose the type of feed line you're using, then enter the length of the line, your desired frequency, your SWR, and how much power you're running, and it'll calculate your loss in decibels and percent, as well as tell you how much power you're really running, as well as how much is likely to reach your antenna once loss is taken into account. The March-April article, The Digital Format Dilemma, introduces the three competing formats that digital transceivers are available in, D-Star, DMR, and System Fusion, and goes into some pros and cons to consider when choosing between a digital VHF transceiver and an analog FM model. One big difference between digital and analog is how they handle weak signals. Most of us know what an analog FM signal sounds like as it weakens. It gets noisy.
1GTW at the Watertown EOC. Has anyone got us on the list? We checked in earlier as KC1AEZ.
There was some static toward the end there, but you could still basically make out what was being said. So with analog FM, you still have a shot at communicating. Digital, on the other hand, behaves differently. When a digital signal weakens to the point where it can't be decoded, it just drops out. The signal falls off what's known as the digital cliff.
This is a drill. Relay emergency test is in progress. Lots of activity on multiple bets. Digital MR data on 2K.
All those little skips and silences are because the digital signal got too weak for the radio to decode. So if you're thinking about going digital, think about whether you're prepared to go over the digital cliff. The article, Severe Weather Spotting, Six Questions Answered, presents an overview of what weather spotting is, how the information gets used, how hams can get involved, and what kind of equipment they need. It also includes an overview of Skywarn, which is a program of the National Weather Service, and Skywarn relies on volunteers to relay ground truth information during weather events. Rob Macedo, KD1CY, was kind enough to give us some more insight into what Skywarn does and how you can get involved. Rob is the Eastern Massachusetts Ares Section Emergency Coordinator and Skywarn Coordinator for the National Weather Service Boston Norton office. So thanks for coming on the podcast, Rob. What is Skywarn?
So Skywarn is the National Weather Service's volunteer weather spotting program where timely severe weather reporting into the Weather Service during all kinds of weather hazards, from severe thunderstorms and tornadoes to tropical storms and hurricanes to winter storms, blizzards, windstorms, flooding, et cetera. Those reports are timely and helpful for protecting life and property and helping with issuance of timely warnings and also verifying the warnings that the National Weather Service issues. It's a nationwide program. The program does not require folks to be an amateur radio operator, but one-third of all Skywarn spotters are amateur radio operators, and many folks that participate in Skywarn are more active when they are involved in amateur radio for a wide variety of reasons associated with the capabilities of amateur radio and what it does to support the National Weather Service.
So in order to be a severe weather spotter for Skywarn, you have to be trained, right? You can't just go do it. You have to have the training.
That's correct. There's a training program that is offered. It's varying lengths. Some parts of the country, there's a basic and advanced weather spotting course. Other places, it is done in one class session itself. It depends on the Weather Service office in the region of the country that you live in. There is also online training from Comet, but that training, while very helpful and certainly worth taking, doesn't get you to be trained as a spotter. The spotter training itself to get you officially as a Skywarn spotter comes directly from the National Weather Service. And now, and depending on the Weather Service office, it could be a live class only, or it could be both a live class and a class you can take online as well. Again, that also depends on the Weather Service office and your part of the country.
You said that the classes vary in length. What's a time frame? What sort of time commitment can folks expect if they think they want to do the training?
Typically, I would say about, you know, 2 to 2.5 hours. If it's a basic and advanced course, it might vary a little bit more, but we would say max it out between 2 and 2.5 hours for a basic class and similarly for an advanced class. It depends on the Weather Service office, how they divide up the material, and if they add additional material if they're doing two different courses.
And what kind of material is covered in the course?
So the material, you know, if it's a basic type of class or in kind of one session, it really talks about the reporting criteria for all the various weather hazards. There's certainly sections that are more in depth on the key characteristics to spot for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, how to measure snowfall, what equipment you'd need for measuring rainfall, types of criteria they're looking for in terms of damage reports for trees down, wires down, that sort of thing, measuring ice accretion, depending on the part of the country that you live in, also actual wind measurements and actually reporting what criteria winds to report in at if you have a weather station. Those are the types of things that are explained in a Skywarn class. So it gives you both the criteria as well as the key cloud features to identify, particularly when looking at severe thunderstorms and tornadoes.
You mentioned a weather station. Does a ham have to have a weather station set up in order to be a storm spotter, or can they do that without a weather station?
No, a spotter does not require a weather station. A lot of times folks that are spotting may run into a thunderstorm and see hail in the thunderstorm, and all they need there is their eyes and be able to give a rough estimate, or even if it's safe to do so, measure the hail and report in that hail size to the Weather Service. As an example, they could be driving up in an area and see flooded roads and report that condition, or road closures due to flooding, or road closures due to wind damage. So sometimes all the spotter needs is their eyes to be able to report in. And arguably in our coverage area, we've even had folks that are blind amateurs participate in Skywarn, and they support things by being a net control operator. Our Hartford Talon County Skywarn coordinator in Connecticut, Roger Genefaber, is a blind amateur who's been involved in the program for many years as a net control and helping to coordinate the operation. So there's many different ways you can help. It doesn't require a weather station, and even folks that are visually impaired and can't necessarily spot can help in other ways by using amateur radio and being able to use radio skills to help support those that can spot and actually report in their conditions.
Rob, you mentioned closed roads, size of hail, things like that. Now, storm spotting is not storm chasing. In the Skywarn training, is there a component of teaching spotters how to be safe when they're out in these situations, and they want to be of assistance, they want to be of service, but they may also need to keep safe as well?
Absolutely. So it is stressed in the spotter training that we don't want people putting themselves in harm's way to get a report. So a lot of cases we are explaining the safe parts of storms to observe in, how to look at areas that the storm may impact it shortly after it's passed so that it's safe for the person to see what's happening. And, you know, in some of the cases I talked about where people may spot flooded roads or hail in their travels, they're just traveling in their, it could be in their normal course of day to and from work. And they're also on their amateur radio and they just happen to see these conditions and observe them. A lot of times that's when folks observe some of these things. They're not really chasing. It's just the storm was in their path and they happen to hit that area. And so we talk a little bit about observing in those cases, and also areas, if there are storms in the area, how to avoid the worst areas where we don't want people putting themselves in harm's way for a report, even though a report from that affected area may be valuable.
So, Rob, what can you tell me about why a ham radio operator might want to get trained to be a severe weather spotter? Why might a ham want to be involved in Skywarn?
So there's a number of different facets that may drive a person's interest. One may be they have an interest in weather, helping public safety with their weather interest. Some may just view it as valuable for the community and that public service to be able to help out in that capacity. Another factor is a lot of our disasters that require an amateur radio response for either communications overload or communications outage could be driven by the weather, by severe weather. And so being a spotter and observing those conditions and reporting in on them to help with the warning process, help with telling people what's actually happening on the ground, providing that situational awareness for both emergency management and the public and even the media, can then give that the media and other sources greater confidence to say what's really happening in certain areas, which can in turn help save lives and property because it's not something that's being detected by radar or satellite imagery. It's something that's actually being observed on the ground. So again, it could be just simply community service interest for their own and for their own interest in weather safety. It could be they're actually very interested in the weather and want to use those skills to help the community and to help response agencies in a disaster with that information. So there's a lot of different reasons folks get involved in the program, and it's a great way to showcase amateur radio's capabilities during a time where public service and community service help is important.
Well, that's great. So if someone wants to get involved, how do they find out where to go get training?
So I would suggest folks go to weather.gov and they can find themselves on the map and click on the Weather Service office coverage area. And each office should have a Skywarn page where you can find out more if they're offering training in the area, if there are other amateur radio groups that may be involved with their National Weather Service, supporting operations both at the Weather Service and out in the field. Weather.gov is the great place to start, and then they can find their coverage area that they belong in, and then learn about training sessions and amateur radio activity in the area. So that's the best way to kind of get more involved in the program. And depending on the location and area, as we stated, the training can be differed, whether it's one or two classes, and also how much they are offered in a particular area can depend on the Weather Service office and the coverage area that they're in and the population density of that given coverage area.
All right. Very good. Well, thanks so much for all this good information, Rob, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, and happy weather spotting to folks, and hope everyone takes an interest in Skywarn. It's a great program.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode, which took a deeper dive into material from the March-April 2020 issue of On the Air magazine. The On the Air podcast will be back in April to build on more content from the issue. In the meantime, feel free to send comments about On the Air to ota@arrl.org, read our blog at arrl.org/ota-blog, or learn more about ARRL membership at ARRL.org. Until next time, I'm your host, Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73.
Foundations of Amateur Radio. A regular lament is the lack of things to do in our hobby. I know, it's foreign to me, but there are plenty of amateurs who express frustration at the lack of activity, no contacts, nothing new, no challenges. For my poison, I started the process of contacting 100 different countries using 5 watts. I've been at it for a number of years, and truth be told, since my latest domestic move over 2 years ago now, my efforts have been put on hold. Not because I didn't want to, but because I was getting annoyed with having to leave my home and wanting desperately to have a functional shack at home. As you might know, that's a project that's still in hand, and thanks to some magnificent assistance from various places, I'm still making progress. That said, your perspective might be dulled by the notion that this pretty much concludes the on-air activity possibilities that exist. Within my own license class, until recently, I was permitted to use voice modes like SSB, AM, and FM, and I was permitted to use hand-keyed Morse. I have access to 10 watts and am currently allowed to use 6 different amateur bands, namely 80 meter, 40 meter, 15 meters, 10 meters, 2 meters and 70 centimeters. So together with the 4 modes, I'd be able to make 24 different contacts to 100 different countries. That's 2400 different combinations. Of course, there are more than 100 countries, that is DXCC entities. The 2018 list has 340 of them. So that's over 8,000 different options for getting on air and making noise. Last year, all that changed. The local regulator in Australia, the ACMA, decreed that all amateurs in Australia were permitted to use all modes. It's taken a little while for that to sink in, specifically what it means for me. A quick search reveals that there are at least 60 different digital modes. Think RTTY, Olivia, PSK31, etc. In addition to those, there's a plethora of other modes like IRLP, All-Starlink, Echolink, Codec 2, and Brandmeister. So, conservatively, I'm going to estimate that I now have got access to over 100 different modes, across 6 bands with 340 countries. That's over 200,000 different options for making a contact. Of course, it's unlikely that I'll make a contact between, say, Belize, Victor 3 Alpha, and Perth, Victor Kilo 6, on 2 metres using Olivia, but even if we limit our calculation to HF, we still have at least 136,000 opportunities for adding something interesting to your logbook. I've been hunting for a canonical list of all the various amateur modes and the tools needed to make and receive them. No doubt that will take me some time. I'll be documenting it on the projects page on Victor Kilo 6 Foxtrot Lima Alpha Bravo dot Charlie Oscar Mike if you want to follow along. Speaking of which, you'll also find past episodes of this podcast there. I suppose I should start by converting my current efforts into some pretty pictures that show what I've been up to so far, but that's a mapping exercise that I'll have to add to my to-do list since I'm guessing it involves learning how to use some fun mapping tools. If 136,000 opportunities isn't enough, you can also add grid squares, large and small, different prefectures in Japan, provinces in the Netherlands, CQ zones across the world or ITU areas, prefixes and operating modes. Clearly, there's plenty to do and see. I wonder if there's an award for all modes, all bands, all countries. And I wonder what happens if someone invents a new mode. I'm Ono, Victor Kilo 6, Foxtrot Lima, Alpha Bravo. Foundations of Amateur Radio. The other day, I bumped into a concept that I've heard repeated before, the so-called impersonal nature of digital modes. There is this idea that any communication that isn't using voice is devoid of the human touch. Often, this assertion is specifically made in relation to modern digital modes, like JT65 and FT8. As an aside, I've never heard it in relation to other digital amateur modes like slow scan television, RTTY, or PSK31. In the early 1900s, when amateur radio was beginning to be a thing, the means of communication was Morse code. With beeps across the globe, contacts were made between amateur stations. With every incoming dit and dar, letters were received, words constructed and meaning derived. This is long-distance communication in its early stages. Each amateur was said to have a fist, their particular rhythm of touching the key. Across multiple stations, it was possible for an experienced operator to distinguish between two amateurs based on how they were sending Morse code. I can confirm that if you've ever had the privilege of hearing lots of amateurs clamour in a so-called pile-up, you can hear for yourself that different stations sound different, even if they're all sending Morse code. So on the one hand, we have this deeply inhuman means of communications, like Morse code, which is, by the language we use, considered to be made by humans, personalised with a fist. On the other hand, we have a deeply technical mode like FT8, which isn't. During the week, I was discussing this change of perception during a haircut. I pointed out that this happens everywhere. For example, in the hairdressing profession, an electric clipper might have been seen as impersonal when it was invented in 1921. Today, it makes quick work of a number one cut. In mobile phone communication, an SMS was seen as impersonal, with voice preferred. But today, the world would look quite different without the 5 billion messaging mobile phone subscribers. In 2013, it was estimated that there were 8 trillion SMS messages and 10 trillion other smartphone messages. As you might realise, behind each of those messages is a human. Well, apart from the spam and the computer notifications, but even those are programmed by a human. So what makes the difference between Morse code and FT8? Why is an SMS impersonal in 1992, but preferred by most today? I'd hazard a guess and state that the experience of the person making the statement has a lot to say about their perception of the nature of the medium. My typing away at a keyboard and seeing words appear on my screen might not appeal to someone who chased a turkey around the yard in search of a quill, but then electricity might also be surprising. It's interesting to me that PSK 31, something that's not particularly thought of as being impersonal, was introduced to the amateur radio community in December 1998 by Peter Golf 3 Papa Lima X-Ray. The first weak signal modes, commonly known as WSJT modes, were introduced in 2001 by Joe Kilo 1 Juliet Tango, only 3 years later. JT65 came around in 2003. We have this situation where PSK31 is not impersonal, but JT65, which is 5 years younger, is considered impersonal, and the popular mode FT8, which is an extension of JT65, is said to be the end of the hobby. If hyperbole would relate to truth, the end of our hobby in sight, we should all get rid of our radios and hand back our licenses. Perhaps we should take a step back and notice that behind every FT8 station, behind every voice call, behind every amateur transmitter is at some point a human with a license. If we're splitting hairs, then a local automatic voice repeater must be the height of impersonal. The other thing I'd like to point out is that how you perceive the use of a particular mode is also important. If you think of FT8 as having a personal beacon in your shack that uses your radio and your antenna to measure how well your signal is heard across the globe, you might just start enjoying this so-called impersonal mode. One of my friends Wally, Victor Kilo 6 Yankee Sierra, now Silent Key, told a story where he was driving down the highway to meet his friend. They were chatting away, using Morse code. Wally in his car, the friend in his shack. Once Wally arrived, the friend wanted to see how Wally was able to send Morse code whilst driving, and could he please see his Morse key. Wally confessed to having whistled into his microphone to make the contact, since he didn't have a Morse key in his car. According to Wally, his friend was off the air for months in disgust. I should mention that my number one haircut looks great, if only for the fact that it allowed me to spend some quality time discussing and contemplating the nature of the hobby that I love. I'm Ono, Victor Kilo 6, Foxtrot Lima Alpha Bravo.
I'm Peter John in English Media. Title music is by Croatian artist Blasko and is published under Creative Commons. You can find this podcast on dmpodcast.net, DM is for Daily Minutes, and on several other platforms. De internetfaciliteiten en studio hardware voor Daily Minutes worden gesponsord door 70MHzShop.nl, 70MHzShop.nl.
Daily Minutes Podcast. Whoever hears this is crazy.
En microfoon naar retour.
Bladibladibladibla.